Upfront, inside Atlanta's entertainment industry, is brought to you by Atlanta's Jazz Station, 91.9 FM, WCLK.
Coming up on this week's show, Upfront talks exclusively to two-time Grammy Award-winning singer Peabo Bryson. I caught up with the music legend recently to chat about his new project, as well as working with the iconic Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, and much more. But first, here's this week's casting buzz and entertainment news with Reva Blue.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Central Casting is looking for a real DJ for the series MacGyver. The DJ must be between the ages of 20 to 30 and must have his own equipment. Shooting will take place on Wednesday, August 8th. If this is you, please submit your name, number, sizes, and a clear photo of you and your equipment to macatl@centralcasting.com with DJ in the subject line of the email. In other related entertainment news, watch the official trailer for Netflix's upcoming series Napoli Ever After at WCLK.com. Violet Jones has a seemingly perfect life, a high-powered job, an eligible doctor boyfriend, and a meticulously maintained flawless coiffure. But after a life-changing event doesn't go according to her plan and a hair-raising incident at the hairdresser, her life begins to unravel. Eventually, Violet realizes that she was living the life she thought she was supposed to live, not the one she really wanted. Napoli Ever After stars Sanaa Lathan, Ricky Whittle, Lyric Bent, Ernie Hudson, and Lynn Whitfield, and is based on the novel of the same name by Tricia R. Thomas. It premieres on Netflix beginning September 21st. That's this week's Casting Buzz and Entertainment News. I'm Reva Blue.
The Atlanta Business League, a proud supporter of WCLK programming, presents the annual ABL Membership Campaign Reception and Business Expo, Tuesday, August 7th, starting at 5:30 p.m. at SunTrust Park's Hank Aaron Terrace on 755 Battery Avenue. Learn about the benefits of ABL membership while ABL member companies display products and services during the Business Expo. Information and registration available at Atlanta Business League.
It all came so easy, all the loving you gave me, the feelings we shared. And I still can remember how you touched me so tender, it told me you cared. Until it was gone. A second once in a lifetime. Maybe too much to ask, but I swear from now on. If ever you're in my arms again, this time I'll love you much better.
This is Coleman Domingo, and you're listening to Upfront with Ray Cornelius.
You just heard the classic love song, If Ever You're In My Arms Again, performed by the one and only Peabo Bryson. He stopped by the Upfront Studios recently to chat about his new album, Stand for Love, which dropped this week. The first single, Love Like Yours and Mine, has held the number 3 slot on Billboard's Adult R&B Songs for the last 2 weeks. Check out our conversation as he discusses this and much more.
Well, good morning, Mr. Bryson, and welcome to Upfront. How are you?
I'm good, mate. And yourself?
I am doing so awesome. I'm so happy to have you here. This is, man, an honor to have you here.
No, it's an honor to be here.
Yeah?
It is.
So I got to say, before we start talking about your new music, I'm gonna take you back a little bit.
Okay.
I remember, and people are going to laugh when they hear this, but I used to sing. I was in the middle school chorus, back in like 1988, 87. And so your song... If Ever You're In My Arms Again was the song that we performed at the state competition. So it was like, and I hadn't heard that song in years. So it was a couple of years ago when you performed for WCLK, our anniversary concert.
That's correct.
I want to say you opened with that song.
Yeah, I actually did. I did open with it.
Yeah, you opened with that song. And so when I was hearing it, I was like, wait a minute, that sound, I was like, yo, that's the song we performed as kids back in middle school.
But you didn't put the two together, did you?
You know what?
It happens a lot.
Yeah,
that's why I'm asking.
I kind of did, but then because she was my chorus teacher was such a huge fan of yours and love songs, and so we were just like, man, we don't want to because we had to rehearse that song over and over and over and over, and we were just like, we are sick of this song. But when I heard it, it brought me back to that time, and I was like, I didn't even realize that that was you.
You know, I get that a lot, and you think that you had a hard time doing it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Working with Michael Massa when he was recording it,
yeah,
he recorded it in two separate keys. He had slaves of about 120 vocal performances of it, and he used all of them to make a comp.
Wow.
He spent an exorbitant amount of money on this one single. I thought the Capitol was going to kill him. He spent more money on the one single than my entire album budget.
Wow.
But they didn't stop him. Because he was Michael Massa, and he's written some of the greatest songs ever. So, but he was a stickler for the melody, and he didn't want anything else. He didn't know anything else because his background is not music. He was an investment guy. He was a Wall Street guy and decided at 35 he wanted to make music and dropped his job, family, everything, and just decided to become Michael Massa, the music writer, producer type. But he made me sing that song every day, 8 hours, every day for 11 days, to a point where I took my headphones off and I said, I'll be right back. And you know what that means.
Yeah.
And we were in a Hispanic neighborhood, the studio was. They looked for me for the next 3 or 4 hours, I'm sure. I walked into the neighborhood and found a cantina. And that's where I was. And my thing was, whatever you don't have, you're not going to get because I'm not going to sing it again.
Yeah.
When he was recording Whitney Houston sing Greatest Love of All, which he wrote, of course, she ran out of the studio crying into that, probably the same cantina, you know. But it's one of those things where he was a perfectionist, and he did not understand the whole human, this is organic thing. He didn't get that because he's probably the worst singer on the planet. Great writer, but the worst singer on the planet. The only person that sang worse than Michael Massa was Burt Bacharach.
Another
great writer,
music
guy's icon, great writer, but him singing a melody to you is, I just cracked up. I kept, cassette tapes of him trying to sing it to me. I kept it for, and I just finally said, at the recording session, I just started laughing. He said, what's funny? I said, you are the second worst singer I've ever heard in my life. And everybody just kind of got quiet, right? And so he hit the talk back button and said, well, who's the first? And that's all he wanted to know. I mean, but it's all good. Those songs and my career, somehow they got detached. And until you think about it, or you're sitting down having a conversation, or you're at a concert of mine and you're listening to a medley or something like that, you'll forget what my anthology really is or my discography truly is.
And that's
it's
so
fast.
True.
It's, you just don't know. It's for some reason, because my musical career has been so diverse, it's hard to connect me with all those odd components.
Well, that night was so magical, and I was telling your publicist, Candace, that it really took me back to a time when people really performed. I mean, you gave an amazing show. I mean, there was some storytelling, there was some comedy, the costumes, you had the real background singers, you had live, it wasn't synthesized, it wasn't, a track.
Exactly.
And so you really took us on this musical journey, because like you said, it started with that, and then you went into your Disney songs. I mean, there was the new stuff. You did a Sade song.
Correct.
Which I was just totally like, wow.
Stop.
Well, let's talk about this. You've got a new album,
sure.
Stand for Love, and I was checking the Billboard charts today. Your single,
Love Like Yours and Mine.
That's it. Is number 3. I mean, you're on the same charts with Drake and LMA.
Now, who would have thought that we would actually be having this conversation today? Right?
Yeah.
It seems unlikely, but that's the thing about standing over anyone counting to 10. You know, first of all, you don't. No one gets to deserve to decide or discern what my portion in life is or what your portion in life is. That's for me,
right?
And for me alone. So I don't, if you don't listen to people, you'd be surprised. I mean, my first number one record was a song called "I'm So Into You." Nobody liked it when I played it for people, but except for 3 people liked it. My manager liked it, David Franklin. My sister liked it, Agnes. And me.
Right.
That was about it, you know?
Right.
And people were suggested that I start all over and, you know, just start the project all over again, get different musicians, get this, that, use different songs. First number one. But you cannot listen. If you allow yourself to listen to someone else's perception of who you are or who you should be, that's an abject lesson to learn. And I always like to pass that on because it's a... Individuality in art is something that is surely missing at this particular point. And for me, there are about a half dozen really great singers out there. And what I mean by great singers is a vocalist that has no limitations, or limitations of ability, range, or genre. That's a great artist. It's a great vocal artist. There are great song stylists out there, you know, and there's a lot of great young talent out there. All that's good. It's just that there's a certain standard that's a little higher than the rest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not just interpretation. You have to have the full Monty, be able to do anything under any circumstances, and have to be able to do that without auto correction.
Right.
If you can do that without auto tune, then you're my Huckleberry.
So that leads me to the next question. What do you think about the current state of R&B music? I mean, because when reading the comments, it was just like, oh my God, real R&B is back. And I'm like, well, okay. I mean, because you have your current singers. I mean, you have folks like Ledisi. You have, you know,
great
and
singers.
Yeah.
There's some great talent out there that can really get the job done. There's a crop of young, talented vocalists who are going to be in that in the category that the aforementioned category, they're right on the cusp of it, you know. Except for if they learn how to save something, you know. In other words, a great vocal performance is like it's very much like making good love. You start with the basics, you establish what that is, and then you move on to the next thing, and you're building as you go. And you're building this crescendo to a conclusion that you hope represents ecstasy for all involved.
Exactly.
And that's the way you have to look at a vocal performance. And if you're giving it all up in the first 12 bars, then where do you don't have any place to go.
Think about love, girl, your face is all I see. Girl, when I think about your touch, you know I hunger constantly. 'Cause we'll be right back.
let's talk about the album. You're actually collaborating with music icons Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. What was that experience like?
Well, first of all, you have to acknowledge them as two of the greatest music makers on the planet. And it's if we were to sit here and start to try to think of every hit record that they've been involved with, we'd be here all day long not get anything else done. But they're so unassuming to be around and in person and personality-wise, and although they have a certain kind of presence, it's not obtrusive or it's not something you feel like you have to adhere to. It's a welcoming kind of presence that they have. I think the thing that's probably that stuck out the most, there were a few things. One was the absence of ego and self-importance. And the veracity in which they plead with you to make a contribution. They want the music to be about you. It's not about them. They don't want a representation of themselves. They don't want to recreate themselves through you. They want the music to be all about you. Their process is totally different from anybody's process I've ever heard of, let alone been involved with. What you do is you sit around in a room in the studio and you chat, not unlike we're chatting now, but about everything. You know, nothing is off the table, philosophically, spiritually, you know, emotionally. We're going to talk about everything, and while you're having this heart to heart chat, they're playing music tracks in the background. That's the ambiance of the room. That's the ambiance of the room is just their music tracks. And I'm sitting here having a conversation, but I'm listening, you know, and I'm going, can you go back a couple of tracks? And he said, why, you hear something? I said, you know, I might, you know. And I listened and I go, He said, you hear something? I said, yeah, I might hear a melody in my head. And he said, he grabs a live microphone off the console and he sticks it in my face and goes, hum it. Go, what? So I hum what I heard in my head. And he said, So go finish it. Go write it. Huh? Yeah. So I went out and brought back what I thought was a hook. I said, yeah, that'd work. Well, that works. Now finish it. Finish the rest. Okay. It's like, so that's.
I didn't know I was coming to work.
Well, you know, I thought that they would try to, you know, so this is about us doing you, da, da, da. There wasn't, the absence of ego is, it's, pre, during, and post is the most astounding thing I've ever seen. You can't help but love them when you the more you get to know them. They're as earthy gets. They are as genuine and generous and kind as it gets. They are more than smart. They're intuitive in ways that you have to think about their music and what it represented, what it truly represents. Their music represents genres of change and evolution in our culture, in our society, in ways that you don't. It defined the moment. Defined through music who we were in different stages of our society and our evolution, up to a certain point, you know. And it's all they all did it all with real music as opposed to whatever else is done. They did it with real music, real talent. What they did for—I mean, I lost my mind when I heard Janet speak in French. Are you kidding? We all did.
I was gonna say. Right. Yeah.
We all did.
Yeah.
I was like, I heard Janet speak in French. I said, "Oh God, listen to that!" And suddenly I was going, "Je ne sais plus quoi vous parler, mais je ne parle pas très bien français, Janet." I wanted to speak French with her. I mean, I couldn't help it. I mean, didn't you?
Right. I was 10 years. I didn't know what she was saying, but I knew I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Well, you know, it's sitting down talking to Jimmy and Terry is like you get an abject lesson in humility and fellowship and brotherhood and all these, everything is all about being straight, good, forward, and unapologetic. Mm-hmm. I kind of like that. I mean, because we're all at that age of being unapologetic, and we don't apologize for being unapologetic at this particular point. So working with them, music-wise. I mean, they're listening to anything, because again, their whole focus is on making the music reflect you in some extraordinary sort of way. Even if it's they don't care. They wanted to see if I was, my challenge to them, make me current without destroying what it's taken me a lifetime to accomplish. And can you do that without destroying anything? And their challenge to me was, if we do it, will you step up? Mm-hmm. You know, and said, sure. So they challenged me in terms of a lot of different genres of music. It goes across the board, just like the concept of Standing for Love running through the middle of all the songs in the project itself. It's not just philosophically connected and or gives a sense of continuity. It is using different genres of music and different lyrics to say something different, because love is a vast thing. There's all kinds of love, and we touched down on quite a bit of it from a lot of different angles and a lot of different ways. It's not just romantic love or relationship love. It's relationship love, but not romantic relationship love just only. It's about love of family, love of life, love of children, love of humanity, love of, it's all kinds of love, and if you, we could talk about this all day long, and still not repeat ourselves when it comes to the subject of love. That's one of the reasons why I've stood for my entire career. My music has always been about it, and it's never, I don't repeat myself. I mean, I don't think that the truth or truth about love is ever redundant. I don't think it could, because love is constantly changing and evolving, mm-hmm. just like life itself and like people are. Unless, you know, we could only hope that we're evolving towards some kind of worldwide kind of understanding about humanity and love and embracing ourselves in a way that we have not to date embraced ourselves. You know, and especially during the times we live in today, where there's so much confusion about what and who we are and what we should be doing and all that. Through all this chaos and all this hatred, both overt and subversive, I've come to the conclusion that America doesn't want me and my culture, our culture, to not have rights. It's just they want a lord over them. Mm-hmm. And it's, in other words, they only want us to have the same rights as they have if they allow it. And then, but that's, then my rights are not yours.
They're not
to,
real rights.
They're not
yeah,
yours
yeah, yeah.
To give or to amen or to, I was born with these rights. They're, in as the Constitution says, inalienable rights.
One last question. You recently had a newborn.
I love this part. I must tell you that I love this part.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
Suddenly it became important to me to leave my name. Mm. You know, it's just at that point in my life where it never mattered to me before. It mattered to me. And when we went to the doctors to discern the sex of our child, I mean, she said it was a boy, and I was over the moon. You don't. You know, it's like I was ready to spend a lot of money to make sure it was a child. There's a guy in New York that's got a 98% success rate. You know, I was, that's my man. I need to talk to him.
Right.
But my wife reminded me of something. She said that you can't live your life by faith and then start to try to play God by choosing the sex of a child and all that kind of stuff. And what about the Hall of Souls? If there is a Hall of Souls, then you don't have any sway over that. To give a child a soul, you don't have any rule over the spiritual mm-hmm. aspects of it. And what you realize when you have a child is you don't have any control over any of it, that all of it is divine.
Right.
And having gone through the entire process, I wasn't fortunate enough to do that when I was with my daughter, in that she was, I was very, very young. I mean, it was like 17, you know. So there was no getting married or any of that, but there was always the responsibility, in which I took very seriously, her mother just didn't. I don't think she loved me like that. You know what I mean? She got married. You know, she didn't love me like that. So these are things that you accept and you move on. And we're great friends and have been for the rest of all our lives, actually, really. So having Kit was it's just different. A boy is different, and it's I don't have any skills when it comes to, you know, what kind of, yeah, I have to think about it. What kind of man is he going to be? And so I'm already started. I'm already whispering in his ear about what he should be and when, you know, what's important and what's not important. Even now, I whisper in his ear and I find a quiet moment. He, like myself, likes the sound of nature. And we sit on the porch, he sits in my lap, and he leans back on me. If he says something or tries to talk, he's. Says what he's got to say if something hits him, but he looks around, he observes nature, but he likes the sound of nature itself. It chills him out for some reason. And while he's there lying on my chest like that, I whisper in his ear already. I mean, he's going to get rite of passage so early. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't mean to inundate him with all that kind of heavy-duty information and wisdom of you know, rites of passage, but you got to start early at this particular point because he's got to internalize that in so many ways. It's got to be internalized before he reaches the point of or the environment of external influences. You know, that's the whole thing. Parenting is something I take very, very seriously. My wife and I both do. And so in terms of he is the product of me marrying my best friend, which is my whole thing of not being married before, because everybody knows I've been engaged 1,000 times,
right?
To a point where you just stop buying the ring, and you have to stop. But this is the most rewarding time of my entire life to have an extraordinary music project, and have people respond to it in such a positive way, and to find myself suddenly relevant again in a conversation with every or anybody else is surreal, you know, in a lot of ways, but not unexpected if one has faith. And it's not about the impossibility of something. It's really based on the veracity of your individual faith and whatever that is. And if you believe in that if you believe in destiny to a point where you think that there's a book of fate somewhere with your name in it and some deeds in it or some actions that belong only to you and that nothing can stop that sequence of events from taking place. And if you add that to a book of fate and faith, then you got something totally different going at that particular point. So in that regard, it was expected. But that's just based on faith and secondhand grace. It's not, you know, that's if you're okay with those concepts and living by those, that's fine. But if you want assuredness or you want something that's steady and constant, and faith is not for you. Mm-hmm. You know, that's but for me it works, and that secondhand grace is something I've learned to truly appreciate, because all those secondhand graces end up becoming one huge grace, and that's the moment I find myself in at this point talking to you. And it's actually a pleasure and an honor to get that off my chest about how and what. I have no illusions about the divine influence in my life. I don't play around with it. I won't disavow it. Not for you. Not for to be in vogue or not anything. I'm just not. I mean, whatever you. I believe in whatever you want to believe in, not believe in whatever you want to believe in. But I think my spirituality has always been a bit pragmatic. What do you lose? You have everything to gain and you lose nothing. Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't you? And it works for me. And it works for a lot of people. Around the globe, it works for a lot of people in a lot of extraordinary circumstances. And this is extraordinary. But being a father now, it gives me a deeper reason and a more poignant reason to wake up every day, a greater reason to find passion and be more fervent in what I believe and what I say to people, and especially what I say to my little boy. Even when he's being rambunctious and doing what little boys do, it's great, and it's a odd feeling to feel that kind of trust and the kind of male bonding that we've been fortunate enough to be able to do. And I'm ticked off right now because he's just been home to London, and he's been now he's in Greece. They're in Greece at this particular point, sitting around the pool, and I'm sitting in the studio with you. I mean, hey, I'm not complaining about that because I have stuff to do, and it's an honor and pleasure to talk with you. But would I prefer to be there with them? Of course I would.
Yeah.
You know, we go to England as much as we possibly can. And as a matter of fact, he was baptized there, so it's good.
Yeah,
it's all good.
Mr. Bryson, thank you so much. Stand for Love, August the 3rd.
Got to stand for it.
That's right. We appreciate you so much for stopping by up front, and best of luck on
that
this
fun
album.
Is cool, man. Thank you.
And with the newborn. Yeah.
The newborn is, Kit is absolutely amazing, and he's my little hacker. He's my secret promotion man, and when we in social media, they love him a lot more than they love me. When you look at his face, it's hard to say no to Kit. He's absolutely adorable and has no idea that he is. Parenthood. That's probably the greatest gift at this particular point. That and the new music is family and friends and music associates, the music fellowship is the greatest thing on the planet. I couldn't be happier or more humble or more grateful. And thank you again for having me.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, that'll do it for today's show. I'd really like to thank my special guest, Peebo Bryson. I would also like to thank my engineer, Jami Wellman, and you. Please join us next Saturday, August 11th, for another exciting edition of Upfront, Inside Atlanta's Entertainment Industry. Happy Saturday, Atlanta. If you like today's show, please hit us up at WCLK.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Upfront, Inside Atlanta's Entertainment Industry has been brought to you by Atlanta's Jazz Station, 91.9 FM, WCLK, an NPR member-supported station.